Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Data. It's the coin of the realm in 2017. We hear about it all the time. Big data will help us cure disease, find the business trends, consumer tastes, bring world peace. But it has a dark side. Data can be hacked and tied to ourselves, which if revealed, be it health or financial data, can be damaging to our safety or reputations. My guest today, Adam Tanner, has a new book that details what he calls the inherent paradox in our nation's vast trove of medical data. That is, when we want a comprehensive file of our own data, it's unnecessarily difficult to obtain or to transmit, ironically due to privacy laws designed to protect us. But when it comes to medical data with our name removed, things like the prescriptions we take, our zip codes, our ages, it's nearly a free-for-all. As you'll hear, there's a multi-billion dollar market in trading anonymized medical data, mostly for the purpose of marketing pharmaceuticals and for tipping analysts and investors about trends in the healthcare marketplace. And it's almost impossible to opt out of sharing this data. We're never asked to give consent in the first place. Adam Tanner is writer in residence at the Harvard Institute for Quantitative Social Science. Before that, he was a foreign correspondent and bureau chief for Reuters. He's currently on a visiting professorship in journalism at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, from where he spoke with me about his new book, Our Bodies, Our Data: How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. Adam Tanner, welcome to the program. I want to start with the second half of the book, an interesting new book, Our Bodies, Our Data, and talk a little bit about the part where, as patients, we're likely to interface with our health data or not, as the case may be. So we've gone from, say, 2008 to 2017, where there's been this massive adoption of electronic medical records. And the promise of this was great. It was that no longer have to rely on the doctor's handwriting, no longer have to have paper charts stuck in a file somewhere that get lost. Now it's all on the computer, and we can transfer the files, and we can have access to our data, and it's reliable, and it's replicable. But that has not been how it's played out. What's the trouble with these electronic health records?
Well, you're completely correct. What we want is that our doctors and people who are caring for us would have the full access to our records so they can give us the best possible care. Unfortunately, our records are still fragmented in many different places, so that if you've gone to different doctors or providers who are not linked to each other, if you've moved to different cities, your records are probably scattered in different places, and they might be a mix of paper records and electronic records. And so this vision of one complete file about you that helps you get your best possible medical care hasn't happened. Part of the reason for the difficulty is that different companies run the electronic health record systems, and these systems have trouble talking to each other. Some people say it's a deliberate trouble talking to each other, because if you can keep as many doctors in one particular electronic health record system rather than a competitor, then you're going to make more money. But it's a rather tangled issue, and despite this more than $30 billion government subsidies in recent years, it's still not easy for us to have a comprehensive access to our records.
So there's this other federal law that predates the High Tech Act, as it was known. It was part of the stimulus in early 2009 that subsidized a great deal of this, as you point out, $30 billion as subsidies to physician offices, groups, health centers, hospitals to adopt electronic medical records, which was in many ways largely successful because it has pushed adoption, I think, well up over 80%. But as you point out, there are a lot of downsides to it. But HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, I think is what it's called, from 1996, this is a law that probably many of us have heard of, HIPAA. We talk about HIPAA training, HIPAA violations, as patients were all forced to assign a privacy notice when we enroll in a health, when we see a health provider. And I think there's often a misapplication of HIPAA where I think folks often feel like their health data should be, you know, and it should be secured, but it shouldn't be so secure that you can't get it yourself. And is that, I mean, did you come across that in your research?
Well, so there is some concern about that. But obviously, as a patient, if you are my doctor and you say, oh, there's a better specialist to deal with you, I'm sending you to him, I want that doctor to have notes based on our conversation. I want them to have as detailed an insight onto me and my past as possible to give me the best possible condition. But despite the kind of confusing array of rules and acronyms that apply to our data, we still don't have that. And in many places, they don't have that. I saw this in rather vivid form just about a year ago. I was lecturing on a cruise ship in the Indian Ocean, and we stopped in the country of Oman. I had just had lunch with an elderly Chinese gentleman who now lived in New Zealand and with his wife. And 2 days later, we were on a bus of about 20 people visiting a very dramatic, beautiful beach coastal landscape area. This guy sat down and he fell over backwards. He had some kind of attack. Luckily, in this group of about 20 people of passengers on this tour, there was a nurse and there was a doctor, and they ran over to him. They were trying to figure out from the wife whether he had pre-existing conditions, whether he was taking medications. They weren't able to find out very much. There wasn't some button that they could push or some document in his wallet that would provide this information. And within about 10 minutes, this guy was dead. And it's just an example of you're traveling. You would like people caring for you to get the fullest access to your records possible to help you. Now, in this case, he might have died anyway. He may have had some fatal heart attack or seizure of some kind, but it's still something that bedevils us despite all of the spending. One more thing about the rules, all that spending that we did in the United States to help encourage doctors to adopt the systems, it didn't require the systems to all talk in the same language. So imagine if it was foreign languages, some systems are talking in German, some are talking in French, some are talking in English. They don't talk to each other in the way that makes the most sense. That's in very basic form what the issue continues to be.
Now, there are many, as you point out, vendors who put together these electronic health records and sell them, for the most part, as off-the-shelf systems and then have long-term contracts to continue to maintain them, upgrade them, et cetera. And you talk to several, I think, of the CEOs of some of the biggest, and we're familiar in this part of Oklahoma with Cerner, because Neil Patterson, who founded Cerner, is an OSU grad. That's Oklahoma State, and has been very successful with that. And then I was very impressed that you, I have tried to interview Judy Faulkner, who is the founder of the still privately held and massive Epic Corporation out of Wisconsin that has, I believe, the largest market share of the electronic medical record market in the U.S. And she was very personable to you and answered your, I guess, called you several times and emailed you. And you found her to have, it seemed like, at least good justifications for some of the things that she and her company have been accused of being very proprietary and not cooperating.
Yeah, there are people, and there are people in the legislatures and so on that have said that her company, which is Epic, has tried to lock down their system so that it'll make them more money. She's a very interesting entrepreneur. She's a woman who started her company in the late 1970s, a rare kind of computer person who was a woman at that time, and she's been immensely successful, but continues to live very much below the radar. She lives in the same town. She lives, I believe, modestly compared to the amount of wealth that she has, but she prefers not to be recognized. She prefers not to go and splash her name and her company all around in the public sphere. Neil Patterson, who you mentioned from Cerner, which is a rival company, the OSU graduate, is an interesting case because his wife has suffered from difficult health conditions in recent years, as has he. And even though he's the head of an electronic records system, a major company, they don't have their own comprehensive record because they go to different doctors. Even these influential officials suffer the same problems as you and I do.
And you paint the picture of her having to schlep, or I guess he on her behalf having to schlep large bags full of paper records from specialist to specialist.
That's right. She's been going to different doctors in different places trying to find the best possible people for care, and she has to literally, as he described it, carry stuff from one place to the other. So obviously the vision we would like to have is that our medical records would be available to the people who are treating us so they could say, oh, I see 3 years ago there's some condition you had that'll give me some insights that I can better treat you today. But that's not yet there.
Adam, we just talked about electronic health records, the kind that a doctor or a nurse practitioner will type in and spend time recording our history now in these electronic charts, and how it's been a bit frustrating that we have a hard time as patients getting our full electronic medical record, or that they're not easily transmittable to our other places of care. But let's move our focus to what really is the lion's share of this book, and something I would say that I was very unaware of, even though I work in healthcare, which is this whole data mining operation, really. And you focus largely, well, on several companies, but particularly this one called IMS, which is a fascinating story. But what's really, I guess, compelling and is your thesis, essentially, is so much of our data is just that, is for sale, and we have really no say in the matter whatsoever. How can that be?
So this is surprising to most people. So you go to see the doctor, and I say, doctor, here's my issue. And the door is closed. It's just the two of us. I'm talking to you, the doctor. It's just the two of us. And you say, oh, go have a blood test. Here's some medication. Go to the pharmacy. Oh, and fill out these insurance records. I presume that all of that is completely private. But behind the scenes, all of that information is sold commercially. Details that I've told you that are in the electronic records, the pharmacy prescription copies are sold. Details of my blood test, my urine test, and insurance details are sold. Now, it is sold anonymously. In other words, your name is taken away from the file, but it says, man of this age living in this postal zip code seeing this specific doctor, and that the doctor is named. And then that information is gathered together over time, and that's the backbone of this multi-billion-dollar industry of medical data mining. Most of that is about promoting the sale and marketing of drugs. So it's a quite lucrative business, but it is one that is almost invisible to patients.
I want to point out, too, that as a doctor who still sees patients, I have no idea that that's going on. So I'm not privy to the fact that even though you and I are having this confidential or seemingly confidential conversation, that these different points of exit, the lab, the pharmacy, or the other specialist, for example, all of those bits of data, which is really what they are then packageable and resellable. And as you point out, with your name de-identified, but some factors that can, in fact, identify you if you look hard enough. And you go to great pains and talk to several computer experts who show with a great deal of reliability that it is not hard to associate those fragmentary bits of data, for example, as you point out, zip code, condition, or prescription information, and where that person has been to the doctor, that you can do what's in fact called re-identification. And so you can essentially hack or figure out who these people are.
So I might be a good example to put this in perspective. So as we're talking right now, I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm teaching here for a year. So if I have medical care here that's added anonymized into my file, it'll be joined with care that I've had in other places. I lived prior to here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the Boston area. And prior to that, I lived in Belgrade, Serbia. I might be the only man of my age who matches for those three cities over the past decade. And so all of a sudden, you have a match. I'm the only one that could be that person. And although it seems like finding a needle in a haystack in the era of sophisticated computing and cheap storage, you are now able to use different pieces of information to match and figure out who people are.
Now, you mentioned that this trade, this multi-billion dollar industry that trades in this anonymized data, is largely for the purpose of marketing pharmaceuticals. How does that work?
So let's take a specific example. If you are my doctor and I've gone to you and you've sent me to a lab, the lab test may show that I have some health condition. I'm proven positive for some disease. And perhaps I've gone to get the test on a Thursday. I'm going to come back and see you the following week. We've set up an appointment on Tuesday. So you can tell me what the lab results were. A commercial company could buy those lab test results. It has not my name, but it does have your name, the doctor. And so they could send a salesperson to you and say, oh, doctor, let me come see you on Monday. I understand you have a patient with this condition. And they'll come and they'll say, look, we've got these great new drugs that will help treat your patient. Now, I'm coming to see you the next day. You may now know some important information, or you might be gung-ho on prescribing me an expensive medication, whereas a cheap generic would be just as good. So this is the kind of way that these companies can use it. Companies also build specific dossiers on doctors to see what they're prescribing to their patients. And if I represent company B and you typically prescribe drugs from company A, I may send my salespeople to see you and say, let me tell you how great our drugs are and let me take you out to dinner and give you some free samples and other ways to convince you.
That really struck me as, I guess, legitimate business practice, but seems somehow insidious. I guess it's really no different from any other commercial transaction. Now, we know that Amazon, for example, looks at our buying preferences and then is therefore able to use an algorithm to say, oh, you read this book and bought this book, you might like this book. You know, and that we tend to find that is pretty helpful, sometimes creepy, but I guess generally pretty helpful because it knows your buying habits. So this, in the same way, as a doctor, I have these proclivities where I may like bagels to my staff or I might like a fancy dinner. But if I do treat patients with certain conditions, I may be much more inclined, especially if a detailer comes in and suggests to me a day beforehand that this new medication, this new blockbuster medication, might in fact help my patient more. What are some other uses of this anonymized data in the healthcare space? Because it's not really just limited to pharmaceuticals, right? I mean, it has investment purposes and trading purposes as well, doesn't it?
Well, so if you are an investor on Wall Street, you could use this data to try to figure out trends in the marketplace. Maybe you're seeing an uptake of a certain kind of new drug and you want to invest in that company because it looked very prospectful. The data mining companies, and you mentioned the biggest one of them, IMS Health, which is recently renamed Quintiles, IMS after a merger, they say that there's a great potential to discover new drugs and to come up with new cures to disease using this information on hundreds of millions of patients. And in fact, a company such as Quintiles IMS says that they have these dossiers on more than 500 million patients worldwide. So far, according to experts, there's not been any amazing breakthrough that they've solved a disease or they have come up with an amazing new drug. They have seen interesting cost benefits and interesting details from all of this data, but nothing that would justify, to my mind at least, this completely hidden trade. I think we should have an open discussion about it and decide, well, what's the best balance in using our private medical data?
Right. I mean, that's the thing about it is it's private medical data. It is somewhat anonymized, but as we pointed out, it can be re-identified, you know, by using those factors of location, zip codes, and age, because with a great deal of, some certainty, I suppose. But I want to also point out some of the risk, which is that there's been a great number of hacks. I mean, we've heard almost monthly, I would say, of large hacks, certainly in the consumer space, I think Target and credit card data. But in your book, you point out that, a number of hacks of various health insurers. And I found this one that you write about that happened to you on, I think it's on like pages 98, 99, which was absolutely shocking, which was that you got a letter from Anthem, which is one of the, I think, the Blue Cross derivatives, in 2015 telling you that your data had been stolen. But what was fascinating to me about that is Anthem never provided you insurance. You got your data hacked out of Anthem, and you weren't one of their insureds. How did that happen?
So this is what's interesting about what I call the big health data bazaar, is that your information is often in many places that you do not expect it to be. So in this case, about 80 million people had been hacked, so I was one of many, many people that have received this letter saying that my name, my social security number, my address, employment information, but not medical information, was hacked. But I said, hey, I've never done any business with you. How can this be? And they did some research and said that my former employer outsourced some of my medical data to someone else who gave it to them for processing, and then Anthem in turn left it in a way that it was susceptible to hacking. So it shows that your data is in wider circulation than you may expect. And it's worth maybe pointing out at this point some of the downside of what would happen if your medical information would be in wide circulation or revealed publicly. Many of us know people who have relatives or former classmates who suffer from mental health issues or sexual health issues or diseases of various kinds. And their lives could be made worse. They could be greatly embarrassed. They could be deprived of various services and goods because of their condition. So, for example, a life insurance company is legally allowed to deny coverage to someone based on their health condition. Companies could decide not to provide you certain goods or services or give you different offers that are not as good based on your health. So this is one of the reasons. Even if you're in spectacular health, you go to the doctor once a year, the doctor says you're in great health, no problem, you probably have relatives or friends or someone who's in a much more vulnerable position. And so this is what the risk is if your information is in wide circulation in ways that may be hacked or potentially in the future re-identified.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Adam Tanner, author of the new book, Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. And we were talking a little bit about the possibility of how, if that information gets out there, it can be detrimental to individuals, especially since even though it is anonymized, we have shown, or Adam in his book shows, how it's not very many steps for someone to re-identify you from bits of your data, even without your name being there. And you pointed out several downsides. So what is a consumer to do? I mean, let's say I'm I'm a privacy person. I'm really not that happy about my data being out there. What can I do to prevent people from chopping up my data and selling it without my consent?
So it's not easy as an individual. So, for example, you said you as a doctor were not aware that there was information that was coming from your office going to data miners. So I could say to you, hey, doctor, do you sell my information? And you would honestly say, no, I don't. But it may be that your electronic records service does sell it, or maybe a middleman service that you use to send my information to the pharmacy, that they sell it. There are some electronic health record systems that do sell the data, others that don't. There are some insurers that do not sell information. For example, Aetna does not sell this anonymized patient information. But it's very difficult to take control on an individual basis. So that's why I think there should be this discussion as should we strengthen the privacy protections of our medical data. Right now, the rules under what we talked about before, under the HIPAA regulations, allow this free trade if it's anonymized to certain standards. That means whether it's your blood test, your prescriptions, some terrible disease that you suffer, if it's anonymized, people can freely trade it without even informing you, let alone ask you for your consent. I think we might want to consider changing the rules to say medical data about you is yours and you should decide whether you want to share it or not. Now, there are lots of great people in these industries and researchers and very dedicated people who want to solve diseases and gain new insights for science. And I think if our hospitals and our doctors and institutions said to us, may we use your data to help advance science? Many of us would say, gladly, yes, please, here, let me sign. I will gladly share my anonymized data to help science. But I think we should have that say. It should be up to we, the patients, because it's our information. That's what I think might be an interesting approach.
You you've come to this medical data quest, and it's really a very well-researched book. I mean, you did hundreds of interviews, I think, over hours and hours and hours. I mean, it's quite clear in the writing. It's interesting to me because your background was as a reporter. You were a foreign correspondent. You worked for the Reuters news agency for a number of years, including being a bureau chief. I believe you mentioned Belgrade, Serbia, but also, I think, in San Francisco. How did you go from reportage to getting interested in data science?
So data and the world of information about us is a huge multi-billion dollar business, not only in medicine, but across all spheres of the economy. And it is fundamentally changing our lives. So I thought this was a quite compelling story to tell. And I have a first book called What Stays in Vegas about the non-medical world of our data and how it is good and bad for us, that it is wide circulation. But companies that deal with our data are often quite secretive about what they do, how they get our information. And the medical data miners that we've been talking about are especially secretive. They do not want to detail their activity. And as you mentioned, I worked years as a foreign correspondent. I had to use some of the same investigative reporter techniques to unveil what they're up to gain some insights. I worked for 5 years covering the Kremlin, for example. I've done research on the background of the 9/11 hijackers who were based in Hamburg, Germany. I was living in Germany at the time. I researched Russian President Vladimir Putin and his background in the KGB. These same skills I had to apply to figure out what were companies handling our data in the United States and elsewhere, what were they up to?
So you mentioned your previous book, What Stays in Vegas, and this is certainly not a tell-all what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, but it's a funny title. But this book is really about how data science is used by, for example, I guess the casino industry to reward and entice gamblers to both gamble more and to come back to and spend as much time as they possibly can in Las Vegas. And all of this, I guess, occurred when the casinos went from being cash businesses largely to sort of credit businesses and having electronic data on all of their gamblers and being able to market as targeted a fashion as possible. So I guess what led you from the vagaries of the Las Vegas gaming market to medical? Was it just one set of big data to another?
So on that first book, on What Stays in Vegas, I wanted to set out what happens with our data. What is the commercial market? How is information about us bought and sold? Initially, I thought, well, I'll devote a chapter to what happens to our medical data. But as I investigated the topic, I realized that it was especially complicated and difficult to find out what was happening with the information. So in essence, I laid that project aside. I spent several more years researching that for this new book, Our Bodies, Our Data. And I did research in Europe, in Japan, in Korea, and across the United States, and try to figure out this international picture. I mean, again, very sophisticated, interesting people have been involved in this business, and it dates back to the 1950s. And it's an interesting parallel situation, because the situation to try to build better health records for patients for their benefit, that dates back half a century as well. But the big money is in buying and selling information for profit, not necessarily in caring for patients. And so the end result is what I call a health data paradox. The information that you want as a patient to help treat you and get you the best care is not easily available, whereas information you might not want in circulation, a dossier about you for commercial purposes, those exist and are freely traded.
Well put. And I think in some ways that's really a great synopsis of the book. And I guess I'm wondering, I was aware of your background as a foreign correspondent. I did not know that you also had done sort of special research on the Kremlin or on Vladimir Putin. So I have to ask you, given our new president, president-elect at the time of this recording, but soon to be a new president who seems to have some kind of strange relationship with Vladimir Putin. Number one, I guess, could you have possibly imagined any of this happening where Putin would have such a role in our own elections? And then number two, under President Trump, do you see any hope for having more restrictions on the use of our data?
So Trump really hasn't spoken about specifically this medical data issue. As with a lot of things, what exactly his specific policies will be is not so clear. So it's hard to say. Now, of course, this issue of hacking and data has been in the news, partially because his opponent Hillary Clinton saw her various aides had their email hacked and whatever. So that's something that he's aware of and concerned about. But also the news more recently that there could potentially be a dossier or damaging information about Donald Trump held by the Russians is interesting to think about in this world of data that we're talking about. Now, typically, if you wanted data to cause harm to someone, it could be information about financial details, it could be information about sexual behavior, or it could be information about health. And so this threat that we've seen of recent, you know, perhaps there is damaging information about Donald Trump in circulation, whether or not it is true, it highlights this danger. And I think of all information, health is just the most intimate, the most potentially damaging for many people, because once that information is out there in circulation, you can't put it back in the genie. And that's where it's different from commercial information. So if Target's credit card information is hacked and you see that someone uses your credit card to buy something somewhere else, the credit card company will typically pay you back. You'll have suffered an inconvenience, but not a lasting damage. Health data is a lot worse. It could be a lasting damage that results from that.
We'll have to leave it there. Adam Tanner is the author of the fascinating new book called Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. Adam Tanner, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to talk to you. Thanks very much.
Adam Tanner is writer-in-residence at Harvard's Institute for Quantitative Social Science, and he's spending the year teaching journalism at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. His new book is Our Bodies, Our Data, How Companies Make Billions Selling Our Medical Records. Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.